as he turned to leave. "Thank you," Kay said. "I knew you weren't like the others." Eric gave her a weak smile, then left the kitchen. He was going to find a way to get Fred, he decided. He knew what her future held, and in that moment, he decided he was going to do something about it. Calvin listened as Shane was brought in. While he couldn't see him, hearing him yelp confirmed it. It was the same cry he'd made many times as a kid when Calvin would prank him. Calvin would creep into the bathroom quietly and stand there for a moment. Then he would dump a glass of ice water over the top of the shower curtain. While that was a fond memory of Shane as he grew up, when he heard that splash, he knew they'd just soaked his son. He also knew that the cold in the building would certainly lead to hypothermia. He waited for the men to leave. Once he heard the door close, he called out, "Shane! Is that you, son?" The effort required to call out was incredibly painful. Calvin slumped back against the wall, holding his side. Shane's arms were already burning, and his teeth chattered uncontrollably.
Yeah, I'm here.
You okay, son?
I'm cold. They took my clothes and threw water on me.
Bastards, Calvin moaned.
Let your body shiver. Don't try and stop it. It's generating heat.
Not enough.
Jess! Hey, Jess! Fred called in a loud whisper.
Jess whispered back.
What?
Is it day or night?
How should I know? It's always dark.
Yeah, tell me about it. I get dizzy if I stand up too long, Fred said, leaning against the wall.
That's why I spent so much time on my ass, Jess replied.
It was a weak joke, but the first joke heard in a while. Fred's laugh echoed through the building.
It's daylight out, Shane said.
Fred looked in the direction his voice came from.
I'm so sorry they did that to you. I wish I could help.
Me too.
Mary was lying on the floor of her cell in a fetal position. She didn't hear the whispers of those down the hall from her. Her head was filled with voices. Despite her best efforts, she couldn't stop them, and they were driving her mad. Curled up, like she was able to get her hands over her ears. She clasped them tightly and rocked back and forth. In an effort to drive the voices out of her mind, she started to hum.
Mary, is that you?
Jess called out. There was no reply, and after a moment, Fred called out.
I think it is. It sounds like she's humming.
A key sliding into a door caused everyone to stop talking. Fred moved along the wall, away from her door. The sounds of boots scuffing and grinding the concrete filled the air. At least two people were there, the faint sounds of their voices echoing down the halls. A key sliding into the lock of his cell caused Shane to look up. When the door opened, he was immediately blinded with the light again. Closing his eyes, he tried to turn his head away. Once again, he was doused with cold water. He let out a howl as the water hit him.
"How you holding up there, sport?"
one of the guards asked, moving into the cell.
"We got a little something here for you, to take your mind off the cold and all. That is, unless you want to go back and talk to Niagata."
"Fuck you!"
"Gonna play tough, huh? That's all right. I like it better this way."
Shane heard the man step toward him, but he couldn't anticipate what would happen next. The man delivered a forceful slap to the bottom of his scrotum, causing his stomach to instantly knot. What little weight his legs had been supporting was now entirely on his shoulders as his knees buckled. The guard laughed.
"Ha ha, looks like it's cold in here."
He laughed again.
"That thing ready?" he asked. "Yeah, you ready?" "I don't want to be in here when this shit starts up," another guard said.
Jess's mind raced, trying to anticipate what torture they were going to inflict next, and on who.
"Just a sec," the guard said, fiddling with something. "All right, you fuckers. We're gonna play you a little music," he shouted.
Before the words stopped echoing off the concrete, music began to blare. The sound was so loud it took a minute for it to even register what it was that was assaulting their ears. Fred immediately sat down to cover her ears.
"Fucking polka music?" she screamed.
Even if someone had been in the cell with her, they couldn't have heard her. Though it was torturous for all, the music was even more torturous for Shane. The speakers were facing his cell, and the sound bore into his head. He was freezing, and his shoulders and arms were now numb. For that, at least he was thankful. The music, if you could call it that, was so loud that it overwhelmed all other senses. He couldn't believe that just a day ago he was out roaming free, and now he was hanging like a sack of meat, beaten, bruised, and defeated. Chapter 7. We bounced down the road in the buggy, following the tracks to a paved road. Mike stopped and got out to inspect the tracks. At the paved road, we got out again.
"Which way did they go?" Mel asked.
"Hard to say," Ted said, as he circled the sand at the edge of the pavement.
Mike pointed to the east.
"What's that way?" "Nothing for a long ways. The river's over there, then several miles of open forest," Danny said.
"Let's start out this way," Ted said, pointing to the west.
"How are we going to find them?" Mel asked, her voice cracking.
"They couldn't have been too far if they were on foot. You take the left and we'll take the right," Danny said.
Mike nodded, and we got back in the buggy. Perez was on the left side, scanning the edge of the road as we drove. Seeing the M4 in his lap made me realize that I'd left mine by the fire pit. Here I was, out looking for someone who'd taken little bit, and I didn't even have my rifle. At least I had my pistol. Mike was driving slowly, and everyone, except for Mel, was looking at the side of the road.
"Hey, Mork, are those your dogs?"
Mike said, pointing in the distance. I looked up to see Meathead and Little Girl standing on the right side of the road. Meathead's ears were up, and he was looking right at us, his tongue hanging out the side of his mouth. Relief flooded me, just for a moment.
"Yeah, that's them," I said excitedly.
If the dogs were here, that meant Little Bit couldn't be too far away. Mike sped up as the dogs darted off into the woods. As we got closer to where they disappeared, I realized we were almost at the entrance to Alexander Springs. The dogs were nowhere to be seen, but I started to have a feeling that I knew who we were looking for. The realization hit me like a ton of bricks.
"Remember that guy who was living back in here?" I asked Ted.
"Yeah, weird little dude," Ted replied, then rubbed his chin. "Didn't he shoot at us when we were coming back from our meeting that day those guys gave us the map?"
"That's the one," I said.
I remembered how dirty he was, with that disgusting tangled beard. And he had a dog. Drake was its name, if I remembered correctly.
He probably lured Little Bit over with him, I thought angrily.
"I'm not going to look for the dogs. Screw it. I remember where that guy was staying," Mike said, as he sped up through the parking lot, heading for the snack bar.
I jumped out of the buggy as Mike slowed to a stop, leaving Mel in her seat. Ted was right behind me, along with Jamie and Perez. Danny and Doc rode past us and up toward the small building. Rounding the building, I was both enraged and relieved. The hermit weirdo was sitting in front of a smoky fire under the canopy of old oaks with Ashley on his lap. He looked up as we ran toward him, a crooked smile on his face. I drew my pistol and started yelling.
"Let her go! Let her go, you sick fuck!"
The filter in my brain for my choice of words around the kids was not functional at the moment.
"She's my friend,"
he replied, grabbing her tighter. It was then that I actually looked at Little Bit. She was crying, obviously scared.
She's not your friend, Mel screamed, as she ran past me and everyone else, not even considering whether or not he was armed.
Ashley reached out, crying and screaming for Mel. The man stood and started to turn, to block Mel. Mike, Ted, Danny, and I were moving in an instant. Mike and Ted were screaming at him to put her down, to show his hands. When Mel got close, the man pushed her aside, yelling something about how she wanted to visit him, to play together. Danny made it to him just before I did and grabbed Ashley. Her eyes were wide in terror as she reached out for him. As Danny started to pull her away, the guy fought back. It was like a tug of war with my daughter in the middle. Coming in between the two at a run, I brought my right leg up hard and fast and kicked the bastard in the balls as hard as I could. He let out a loud groan as he started to fall. Danny scooped Ashley up and moved her out of the way, and Mel quickly intercepted her. Doc shielded Mel and Ashley and pushed them out toward the buggy, sheltering the two as he quickly guided them down the walkway to the parking lot. Mike and Ted moved in and pinned the creep to the ground, searching him for weapons. Seeing he was under control, I went to Mel and Ashley. They were sitting in the buggy in the leaf-littered parking area on the other side of the concession stand. I walked toward them, my mind racing a mile a minute. I was thankful we'd found her, and yet was worried about what we didn't yet know. Ashley had her face buried in her mom's neck. I tried to lift her head to look at her, but she was clinging on with surprising strength. Her little form was racked with sobs, as was Mel. I patted Ashley on the back as Mel looked up, tears soaking her face. I leaned in and kissed Ash's head, then Mel, and looked back toward the concession stand. I could hear the guys shouting at that son of a bitch. Without hesitation, I headed back toward them. When I returned, the guys had him sitting in the chair. Strings of spittle stretched from his beard to his shirt, and he'd vomited on himself. He was obviously in a lot of pain, clenching his eyes shut, leaning forward at the waist with his knees together. Mike stood behind him, one hand on his shoulder. They'd bound his hands with a set of cuffs. Ted was in front of him, pacing and asking questions. Between gulps of air, he spoke.
I told you, she came to visit me.
Ted knelt down and looked at his face. The man's eyes were closed, so Ted slapped him in the side of the head.
Look at me.
He half opened his eyes at the command, his mouth hanging open.
You took her from by the river, didn't you?
He shook his head, the strings of spit swinging as he did.
No, I didn't take her. She wanted to come. We're friends.
I stepped toward him.
She's 8 years old, you sick fuck. She's not your friend.
Leaning forward, he looked up, a disturbing smile on his face.
She is my friend. This guy's lost his fucking mind, Ted announced as he stood up. What are you gonna do with him? Jamie asked.
The man laughed.
She'll come back, you'll see. Next time, you won't find us.
Hearing those words, I lost it. I put the muzzle of my pistol an inch from his head just above his ear and fired. His body fell out of the chair as the .45 bullet tore the top of his head off.
Oh my God! Jamie screamed. Shit, Morgan! Mike yelled as he stepped back. Give me a frickin' warning next time. Look at my pants.
Mike was looking down at the specks of blood, tissue, and small shards of bone that covered his left leg.
Ah, for fuck's sake, he shouted, as he knelt down and grabbed a handful of leaves to wipe it off.
Jamie had her hand over her mouth, her eyes wide. She was looking at the corpse, smoke still coming from the side of the head. Perez simply stood there. No expression on his face whatsoever.
Well, so much for that,
Ted said as he knelt down and took the cuffs off.
I can't believe you did that, Jamie said.
Yeah, Jamie. Morgan's a little... different, Mike said. I spit on the body and went back to the buggy. Danny was sitting beside Mel in the back seat, rubbing Ashley's back while Mel rocked her from side to side. Doc was trying his best to examine Little Bit, but she was really clinging to Mel. Danny climbed out and stopped beside me.
Has she said anything? I asked.
He shook his head and nodded toward the snack bar.
That taken care of?
Doc climbed out.
Morg, she looks all right, but I'll really need to do a more thorough exam when we get back.
Thanks, Doc, I said, looking at her and Mel. I hope you're right. Danny patted me in the back and walked toward the other vehicle. The dogs came trotting up, tongue still lolling out of their mouths. I smiled at Meathead and thought to myself, thanks, old buddy. Mike started up the buggy as Danny pulled up beside us. It was a quiet ride back to the cabins, the few miles seeming like many more. No one said anything during the trip. Gone now were the sobs and tears. A tempered sense of relief filled me. Tempered because there was still one question to answer. Pulling up to the cabins, we were met by Thad, Ian, and Jeff, whose looks of relief reminded me how good of friends they are. Mel quickly got out and headed for the cabin with Ashley. I caught up to her and grabbed her arm.
When you go in and clean her up, check her clothes.
I didn't know exactly how to say what needed said. For, you know, I left the terrible thought unsaid. Mel stared at me blankly, spun on her heels, and went into the cabin. Bobby was right behind her.
I'll go check her out, Doc said quietly.
Taylor and Leanne were sitting by the fire. It was clear that both of them had been crying.
Is she all right?
Taylor asked. I nodded.
She's going to be okay.
Leanne looked up.
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it. I didn't mean for it to happen.
I know. No one's blaming you, I said.
She started to cry and quickly stood up and ran off.
Hey, Leanne, come back!
I called to her, then looked at her sister. Go keep an eye on her. She shouldn't have left her alone.
True, but it's not her fault, and you better not be saying it is.
Taylor walked off after her sister, passing Thad on her way. He put his hands in his pockets and leaned back on his heels.
Leanne's pretty upset. She's blaming herself.
She shouldn't have left her little sister alone, but it's not her fault, I replied, still looking at Taylor.
You'll need to talk to her. Taylor gave her some trouble about it, which didn't help.
I shook my head.
I'll talk to both of them.
Thad nodded and went over to the fire pit and sat down. I followed him. Everyone was gathered there, and I could feel them looking at me, though no one said anything. I'm sure the word had already spread, and they all knew. On the table was a muffin pan full of soap. Thad had finished his project while we were gone. People started talking, but my attention was focused on the pan. I watched the soap as it began to harden before my eyes. It was a necessary distraction for my mind at the moment. Taylor and Leanne had come back and were sitting in chairs by the fire. Danny was knelt down between them, talking in a low voice. I was thankful Danny was there. He was offering the comfort I couldn't at the moment. He and Bobby were so close to us, part of our family. I couldn't imagine not having them. Doc sat down beside me as Danny propped a foot up on the bench across from me. I looked at Danny, then at Doc, hoping beyond hope.
We looked at her clothes. He paused for a moment. We didn't see anything, you know, that would show...
I raised a hand to stop him. I'd heard what I needed to, and didn't want that thought to enter my head again, ever. Doc left, and Danny sat down. As bad as it is, it could have been worse. Thankfully, she's okay. I nodded. Thanks, Danny. Danny folded his hands, laying them on the table in front of him. Between you and me, and the other guys, nothing will ever happen to one of them again. I've been staring off at the tree line across the river. I looked him in the eye.
I hope not.
You gonna be all right? I nodded. Yeah. I'm gonna go check on her, I said, and stood up. No one in the group stopped me, which was good. I appreciated the concern and the help, but I didn't want to keep hearing their sympathy. Thad was standing at the fire, eyes locked on mine. Several large pieces of pork were sitting on the grill, the fat snapping and popping as it dripped into the flames. He gave a quick knowing nod, then went back to tending his meat. I smiled at him. The circumstances that had brought the two of us together were certainly interesting, and I was incredibly thankful to have him in my life as well. Besides Danny, there was no friend I trusted more in this world. I stopped by the fire for a moment and knelt down between the girls, asking if they were all right. They said they were, and asked about their little sister again. I told them they needed to be especially nice to her and to look out for her. I also told them she probably wouldn't want to be alone, and they would have to tolerate her hanging around with them. She was surely about to become their ever-present shadow. They nodded silently, agreeing with me. When I got to the cabin, I found Mel lying with Ashley, who was asleep. Mel was running her fingers through her hair, watching her. "How is she?" I asked. "She's fine now," Mel said, without looking up. Ashley's eyes opened. "Daddy?" she said, reaching a small hand out. I grabbed her hand. "Right here, little bit. Right here." She wrapped her hand around my thumb and closed her eyes. Soon her breathing settled into a slow rhythm. I rubbed her hand and settled in beside Mel. Soon, we were all asleep. When I woke up, it was dark. Little bit was sitting up. "I'm hungry, Daddy." Mel sat up and looked around. "How long did we sleep?" "I don't know, but she's hungry. Let's go get her something to eat." Little Bit walked between us, holding our hands. Everyone was out at the table, with a couple of kerosene lanterns set out for light. They were talking and laughing. As we came into the light, Mike called out, "Hey! Glad to see you're up there, Sleeping Beauty. Enjoy your nap." Little Bit smiled. "I did. I'm hungry." Mike smiled back. "I bet you are, Ashley. But I was talking to your daddy." She laughed. "He's not Sleeping Beauty." "You're right. No beauty there," Danny said. Room was made for us, and we sat together on one end. "What's for supper there, Grandpa?" I asked Dad. He laughed. "Grandpa?" "Yeah. Remember the old show, Hee-Haw? What's for supper, Grandpa?" "Aw, damn. You're really dating yourself now, Morg," Ted said with a chuckle. "What's Hee-Haws?" Little Bit asked. "Just an old show," Mel said. Then, looking at me, added, "A really bad one." This got a laugh out of everyone. "Well, tonight we're having some roast pig and fried rice," Thad said, as he prepared plates for the three of us. Leanne and Taylor carried them over. When I got my plate, I looked at the rice. "Fried rice, huh? Who pulled this off?" It actually looked like fried rice from the before, with carrots and peas in it. It even had the egg. "I did," Mike said, waving a hand. "Y'all didn't know I could cook, did you? More than a pretty face here, boys and girls." Ted was picking through the rice with a fork. "I'm still not sure you can." "Phew, hater," Mike said, with a dismissive wave.
little bit seemed surprisingly normal during dinner. Danny was sitting across from her, making faces at her, and chewing up mouthfuls of food, and sticking out his tongue to reveal them, which had her rolling. Jamie was talking to her and Mel, as was Bobby. It was as if it never happened, which was good. I just hoped it stayed that way.
"Ian, Jamie, Perez, you guys get enough to eat?" Ted asked. Perez sat back and patted his stomach. "I haven't had anything that good in a long time."
Jamie looked at Thad.
"It was wonderful, really good," she said, looking around the table. "Thank you all for sharing with us."
"I've never had enough, but I'm good. Thanks, guys," Ian said with a smile.
Mike raised his hand.
"I'm good, too, in case anyone's wondering."
Ted leaned back and folded his arms over his chest, looking sideways at Mike.
"We're not."
"You guys about to head out?" Danny asked.
"Yeah, back to the real world," Ted answered.
"Interesting choice of words," Jamie remarked.
"Thad, since you made dinner, I'll take care of cleaning up," Jeff said.
"I'll help you," Bobby offered.
The two began collecting the plates and bowls as Ted and company started getting their things together. Before they left, I thanked everyone for their help with Ashley, though it went without saying.
"Don't sweat it, man. There was no way we wouldn't have," Mike said.
"Morgan, thanks for the hospitality," Ian said. He looked as though he wanted to say more, but instead he stuck out his hand.
We all shook hands, telling each other that if anything was needed, to call. The guys said they would stop by on the way back. We watched as they got in the buggy and drove away. Once even the sound of it was gone, we finally started back toward the fire.
"You going back tonight, Doc?" Thad asked.
"Nah, it's dark. I'll wait till morning. That damn latrine ain't going anywhere."
"Piss tubes?" I said in the dark.
Doc laughed.
"Yeah, that's what I'm doing. You'd think they didn't know shit about sanitation over there."
"Well, Doc, if you need any help,"
I was saying until he cut me off.
"Don't worry about it, but thanks."
"I was gonna say, don't call me," I said with a laugh.
Doc laughed.
"Thanks, Mork. Nice to know who your friends are."
"Yeah, moving, roofing, and plumbing will sort your friends out quick," Thad said.
We all laughed. It was a good way to end a rough day. As we walked back to the cabin, I put my arm around Leanne's shoulders. She hadn't said anything all evening.
"You know what happened wasn't your fault, right?"
She stared at the ground and shrugged her shoulders.
"It's not your fault. There's only one person to blame, and he's been taken care of," Mel said.
Without looking up, Leanne spoke.
"If I hadn't left her alone, it wouldn't have happened."
I was surprised when Little Bit spoke up.
"I'm sorry I didn't listen to you, Leanne."
I gave her a little smile, then rubbed Leanne's head.
"See? She doesn't blame you."
But even with that, Leanne kept her eyes glued to the ground. Chapter 8 Mike was at the wheel driving the buggy through the forest, while Ted was navigating for him using the updated map for guidance. After a short security check, they crossed Highway 19. They decided that they would start on the south side of the camp to find an observation spot. They looked for a place to set up in a small bayhead, which was thick with cabbage palms, small oaks, gum trees, and other brush. Mike drove in from the south, keeping their entrance and escape on the opposite side of the swamp from the camp. Once in, the small group set about camouflaging their location. Great effort was taken to cover their tracks and hide where they had driven off the road. An inspection of the road revealed that there hadn't been any traffic in some time, foot or wheeled.
"I wish we could get this damn wagon closer," Ted said.
"Me too. I'd like for a quick exfil should we need it," Ian said.
"I'm not worried about that. I want to use the cameras on the battle wagon. They'll keep us from having to get too close,"
Ted replied. "We'll just have to do it the old-fashioned way," Ian said.
"Yeah, all right.
Now let's talk assignments," Ted said, taking the lead. "Jamie, you and Perez are going to stay here as our security."
"Why, 'cause I'm a woman?" Jamie asked as she crossed her arms.
"No, it's because Ian said you're a really good shooter." Jamie's expression changed slightly. Ted continued, "And I don't need shooters right now. I need people trained as observers. Have you been to sniper school?" Jamie snorted.
"No, but I can still handle the job."
"Not saying you can't, but this is just the way it's gonna be," Ted said, making it clear the issue was closed. He looked at Perez, waiting for him to protest too. Perez raised his hands.
"I'm good. I'm in no hurry to die."
"Good, me neither," Ted replied with a smile. Once the security team was chosen, they went through radio procedures. The observation team would call in 3 times a day. Just in case there was trouble and the group was discovered, they covered the planned exfil route and rendezvous points, of which there were several.
"If we get found," Ted said, as he dug into his pack, "throw these into the woods."
He handed Jamie 2 white phosphorus hand grenades. Ted went on to show them the possible locations for the incendiaries to be used, giving each location a letter code. These incendiaries would set fire to the forest, creating a diversion for the guys inside the fence to escape. It was a drastic measure that everyone hoped wouldn't be necessary.
"You know, if we set these off, it will start one hell of a wildfire," Perez said.
He was right. The area was dry, and there hadn't been rain in weeks. Ted nodded.
"I know, but when it comes to it, I'd rather burn the woods down than die."
He looked back at Mike and Ian. "You guys ready?" Both men nodded, and they headed out, leaving Perez and Jamie to get settled into their new home. Ian took point, carrying a saw. Ted had Sarge's M1A, and Mike was carrying the 203. While contact wasn't the point of the mission, they wanted enough firepower to break it if it happened. They moved very slowly through the bush, taking a step and listening, then taking another. It took them hours to reach the road that ran around the perimeter of the camp. They crawled up a small hill that had cabbage palms on it. From there, they could see the road.
"How the hell are we going to cross that without leaving any tracks?" Mike asked.
"I don't know," Ted replied. "But we got to figure it out. From the looks of all those tire tracks, the feds must patrol this regularly."
He pulled out a set of binoculars to take a better look, then pointed east.
"Let's move that way."
The guys nodded, and Ian took the point again, first moving back into the woods for cover, and then turning parallel to the road. The ground was a steady, slow slope down, and they continued to follow the contour. After a few hours of this movement, Ian held up a fist and slowly dropped to his knee. Ted slipped up beside him. Ian pointed out in front of him. There was a small branch of flowing water crossing their path. Ted patted him on the shoulder and moved past him. The water was flowing across the road from the direction of the camp. Ted surveyed the situation. There was a culvert running under the road, but a lack of maintenance had allowed sand to fill it, so now the small flow of water was washing over the road itself. Satisfied that the flowing water would help cover their tracks, he decided this was the best place for them to cross. Ted moved back to the other two men.
"Here's where we'll set up and watch the road. We need to figure out their patrol routine before we cross."
Mike and Ian nodded, then began to look for hides to observe the road from. The men positioned themselves close enough to be able to speak in whispers. Once they were settled in, Ian said he would take the first watch. Mike told Ted to get some rest, and he would pull security. Ted didn't argue. He could use a nap, he said. He looked at his watch. It was 3:25.
Even if asleep, men conditioned to combat can wake up nearly instantly. A low whistle caused Ted's eyes to snap open what seemed like minutes later. Instead of jumping at the sound, Ted took in the scene for a moment, then looked at Mike. He was pointing at the road. Ted looked up to see a Hummer slowly rolling by. There were two men in the front and two in the back, along with a gunner in the turret. The truck was black, with the DHS logo on the door. Ted shook his head, looking at the gunner.
"What in the hell does a law enforcement agency need an M240 Bravo for?"
The gunner in the turret sat behind a heavy machine gun. In the before, there was much talk about the amount of equipment the DHS was buying, things like MRAP vehicles, or mine-resistant armored patrol vehicles, billions of rounds of ammo, MREs, everything an army preparing for war would need. It was now rather obvious what it was all for. They watched as the truck rolled out of sight. As soon as it was gone, Mike whistled again. He pointed at the road with an arching motion.
"Let's cross now," he said in a loud whisper.
Ted looked at the road hesitantly, then back at Mike and Ian. They both nodded. The three men jumped to their feet and cautiously but quickly made their way across the road, walking in the small flow of water. Mike crossed first, taking up a position to provide security for the other two. Once across the road, Ted looked back at the truck, watching as the water cascading over the road washed away the mud stirred by their crossing. It wasn't long before it was back to a clear flow again, and the tracks left by their boots were nearly imperceptible. The fence was their next obstacle. Cutting it was out of the question, so Mike climbed to the top and straddled it. All the packs were handed up to him, and he tossed them over one at a time, then climbed down inside. Ted quickly followed, with Ian right behind him. The last real obstacle behind them, they took a short break. Over sips of water, Mike asked,
"Which way you want to go?"
Ted looked around, trying to determine the best way to cut through the brush. They couldn't see the camp from where they were. It was still at least a mile off.
"Let's make our way north, till we can get it in our sights. Then we'll figure out a place to watch from."
"Sounds good to me. Let's get going. We aren't getting anywhere sitting here," Ian said.
The three men quietly strapped on their packs and headed toward the camp. Jamie sat under a piece of camo net concealing her hide. She wasn't happy about it either.
"Jamie, you stay here. What a bunch of BS. They think since I'm a woman, I can't pull my own weight, assholes."
She looked over at Perez, who was stretched out with his hat pulled down over his eyes.
"Look at him, just lying there. Typical. They'll see. I can do my part."
To occupy her time, Jamie sorted through her pack. She knew everything that was there and exactly where it was. It was just something to do. She laid out her poncho and arranged the belts of ammo for the saw. At the sound of an engine drifting through the trees, Jamie's head snapped around, trying to pinpoint its location. She quickly settled in behind the saw, scanning the area to her north. It sounded like a slow-moving Hummer.
"I wonder if they found the guy's tracks," she thought.
The engine continued on. She tracked it as it passed, never seeing it through the thick brush. Perez sat up.
"What's going on?"
"There's a Hummer out there."
Perez scrambled around, grabbing his weapon.
"Why the hell didn't you say something?"
he barked in a harsh whisper.
Jamie glanced over. "I had it under control."
Perez crawled up beside her.
"Next time, you better wake me up. This isn't some game. This shit is for real."
"What? You're like them? Don't think I can handle myself?" Jamie asked, without looking over.
Perez grabbed her shoulder. Jamie twisted her head to look at his hand, then at him.
"Jamie, this isn't about whether you can do this or not. You're here, aren't you?" Out of all the people at the camp, they brought you, and you're sitting here thinking they don't trust you?
Yeah, whole lot of good I'm doing, babysitting this damn go-kart.
You are fucking hard-headed, aren't you?
What we are doing is every bit as important as what they are doing. This isn't some kind of competition, trust me. You'll get your chance to kill.
Perez gave her a hard look.
I hope it's everything you expect it to be, he added.
Jamie didn't say anything as she adjusted the saw on her shoulder and peered down the barrel. It was nearly dark when the camp came into view. Using the terrain to their advantage, they came upon it while in a draw between two small hills. Ted was on point. Raising a fist, he slowly lowered to one knee. Ian and Mike did the same. Whether stalking game or men, they knew it was always best to be slow.
We need to find a place to hide, Ted said, looking at the edge of the camp. Mike, you go to the left, and I'll go to the right. No more than 100 yards, and then we'll meet back here. Ian, you're on security.
Mike nodded, dropping his pack so he could move with some stealth, then began easing through the woods. Ian came up and to the edge of the woods and set up his saw, as Ted moved in the opposite direction. Ian pulled a small monocular out of his blouse pocket and looked out across the camp. With all the brush, he could only see the tops of the numerous tents and structures. What was most shocking, though, were the camp's use of things from the before. Lights illuminated the camp, casting an eerie glow, and he could hear the hum of generators. Diesel exhaust rose up through the light towers. He shook his head at the sight. It wasn't long before Ted gave a low whistle to let Ian know he was back.
Hope Mikey finds something, 'cause there's nothing that way, at least not without having to go halfway around the camp.
He flopped down beside Ian.
What's it look like out there?
Lots of lights. Look at that place, Ian said, with the monocular still held to his eye. Ted pulled his pack over and pulled out a spotting scope. Surveying the site, he was blown away by how large the camp was.
It's fucking huge.
Yeah, and we can only see part of it from here. Ted continued to examine the camp, sweeping the big glass back and forth. After a few minutes, he looked off in the direction that Mike went.
Damn it, Mike, where the hell are you?
Ian looked over. You think something happened to him? Ted shook his head.
Nah, not likely. The kid's scary good, actually, despite his mouth.
Ted turned back to the spotting scope. A low whistle told him Mike was on his way in. Ted looked at Ian.
Here he comes.
Mike crawled up from behind, lying beside Ted. Still looking through the scope, Ted asked,
Well, what'd you find?
There's a little hill about 150 yards over there. The ground in front of it falls off, and there is a slash pile on top.
Perfect place to make a hide.
Sounds good to me. How far is it from the camp?
About 300 meters.
That'll work. Let's move out, Ted said, as he stuffed the scope back into his pack. Lead the way, Mikey.
Mike led them back toward the fence, making a wide loop so that they arrived at the hide spot from the rear. It took most of the night to get the hide set up properly. They had to dig into the pile to maintain cover over them and provide plenty in the front as well. A secondary hide was prepared behind the first for whoever was pulling the security duty.
The sun's going to be coming up soon. Who wants the first watch? Ted asked.
I haven't had this kind of fun in a long time. I'll take it, Ian said.
Sounds good to me. I'm tired, Ted replied.
Ian crawled into the hide, and Ted unrolled his sleeping bag beside Ian.
I'll go back to the security hide. I'll be up for a while, Mike said,
then looked toward the camp.
What's that fucking noise?
Sounds like music, Ian said.
Not any music I've ever heard. It's frickin' loud, too. Mike replied. Well,
Hopefully it won't keep you from your rest, Sleeping Beauty.
Get some sleep,
Ted said, as he pulled his bag up over his head.
It's definitely coming from that building there, Ian said, trying to get a better view through the scope.
Examining the sketch Ted had been working on, Mike asked,
Building number 7?
Yeah, it's got that fence around it. Kind of weird it's sitting apart from all the others. Mike looked through his binoculars.
Think it's a segregation unit or something?
Be my bet.
Remember Abu Ghraib?
They played Eminem real loud to loosen up the detainees.
Yeah, ever tell you I was there once? Mike asked.
You and your stories. Thought you were going to security position, Ted said.
This is more fun.
Fine, then. I'll put you to work. Call the other team and let them know we're in position. 10-4, on it.
After Mike called, they spent the next couple of hours marking up the drawing of the camp. All of the structures inside the camp were given numbers and approximate ranges. From their hide location, they could see the rear gate, so they also spent time tracking the camp employees and counting their vehicles.
Gotta love the fact that government puts numbers on everything, Mike said, adding a hash mark to a column on the list before him.
Sure makes counting a lot easier, Ted said, as he swiveled the scope. Hey, check out Building 7.
Mike picked up his binoculars and scanned the building.
Looks like someone's going to work.
They watched as a group of 4 people approached the building. One went in, while the rest waited outside.
Is one of them wearing scrubs? Mike asked.
Yeah, she is. Looks like a nurse or something, Ted replied.
She? What's she look like?
I can't tell with these.
Ted clicked his tongue.
Now's not the time, Mikey.
Can't blame me, though, can you? Oh, hey, listen, the music stopped.
With the music now off, the individuals waiting outside opened the door and disappeared.
Let's see what happens here, Ted said.
Chapter 9. After the events of yesterday, I figured now was as good a time as any to make pancakes for breakfast. Everyone was sitting around the fire or at the picnic table. Even the dogs were lying in the sun, all 3 of them.
That's right, 3.
The creep's dog followed us home, and we decided to let him stay. Little Bit was sitting close to Mel. She hadn't ventured very far from us since she returned.
I felt like one of those hibachi chefs, with everyone sitting around watching me mix up a bowl of pancake batter.
I used the pancake batter we had left and cut it with about 1/3 cattail starch. I had the stove set up with 2 cast iron skillets, heating up some of the rendered pig fat. I scooped up a spoon of batter and let it run out into the bowl.
How's that look? I asked.
Looks good to me, Mel said.
Looks yummy, Little Bit said, bouncing up and down in her seat.
Get to cooking, man, Jeff shouted as he banged a fork on the table.
All right, if you guys just can't wait, I said as I turned to the skillets.
We can't. Now, get cracking, Danny said.
I spooned the batter out into the skillets, making cakes nearly the size of the pan.
All right, who gets the first one? I asked.
I was showered with shouts from everyone at the table. I laughed and watched for telltale bubbles to form in the batter in the pan.
Daddy, can I flip them? Little Bit asked.
Sure, come on over here.
I helped her get the spatula under the cake, and she flipped it successfully, then did the next one. When the other side was browned, I had her take them out and put them on a plate as I quickly poured in more batter. I then took the plate from Little Bit and set it on a grate near the fire to stay warm.
We'll wait till there's enough for everyone, I said.
Naturally, I was met with a chorus of jeers. In about 10 minutes, there was quite the stack of cakes. Jeff reached for the first plate, a huge smile on his face. I slapped his knuckles with the spatula.
Ladies first, you damn Neanderthal.
He jerked his hand back, shaking it.
Damn, that hurt.
I set the first plate in front of Mel, then another in front of Bobby.
Leanne, how many you want? I asked.
She didn't look up, just shrugged her shoulders.
Come on now, one or two, how many?
I don't care, she replied. I slipped two onto a plate and set it in front of her, then served her sisters. Once all the ladies had their breakfast, I passed a plate to Thad. He quickly poured syrup on them. Taking a big bite, he looked at Jeff and smiled as he chewed.
Mmm, mmm, he moaned.
Jeff sat there shaking his head.
Y'all ain't right.
With a big smile, I set a plate in front of him.
Here you go, princess.
Once everyone had a plate, I sat down with one.
Well, how are they?
These are just like the ones you used to make, Dad, Taylor said.
They're great, Little Bit shouted.
Yeah, these are really good, Danny said. It was universally agreed that they were a hit. It didn't take long for the table to be littered with empty plates, except for Leanne's. She had barely touched her food. I looked over at Mel and nodded toward Leanne. She put her hands up in the air as if to say, I don't know. After finishing up the meal, Doc took off, thanking me for the breakfast. We said our goodbyes, and the rest of us sat around the table a bit longer, full from the pancakes.
Guys, we got to get serious about hunting. We're almost out of meat, and the other stuff is nearly gone, too. We need to focus on getting some protein, I said, as I stirred the fire with a stick.
I'm up for some hunting, Jeff said.
Me too, Danny added. I want to go get a gator.
Jeff's head jerked around.
A gator?
Hey, that'd be fun. I'm in.
I'll cook it if you kill it,
Thad said, shaking his head. Looking at Thad, I said,
we'll let them go lizard hunting. You want to help me rig up some limb rat snares?
Sounds good to me.
Let's go get the canoe, Danny told Jeff. Jeff jumped off the picnic table.
Let's do it!
I got up to go get some snare wire from the cabin. After finding the wire, I dug around the bottom of my pack, pulled out a small package of MRE peanut butter, and headed back to the picnic table, where Taylor and Leanne were chatting with Thad.
Morg, I've never rigged up a squirrel snare. How do you do it? Thad asked.
Before I could answer, the girls piped up. Can we help, Dad?
Sure. I'll show you how to do the first one, and then you guys can make the rest. First, we have to make some loops out of this wire. Using my Leatherman tool, I cut a piece of wire about 2 feet long, then folded it in half.
Hey, Taylor, can you go get me a couple of nails, big ones?
Taylor nodded and left to go find some as I continued cutting pieces of wire and folding them in half. When she returned, I took one of the nails and laid the fold of wire over it. Holding out the two tag ends, I told Leanne to take them, one in each hand. Now, while you hold it, I'm going to twist the nail so the two pieces of wire are twisted together. Thad and the girls looked on as I twisted the wire up. When it was finished, it was nice and uniform, leaving a small loop in the one end and about 2 inches of untwisted wire on the other. Now, we pull the nail out and feed the other end through the loop. I slid the tag end through the loop, making the snare, and held it up, sticking 2 fingers in the big loop. See, with the wire twisted, when a squirrel gets in it and the snare closes, I pulled the snare around my finger. The twists act like locks and hold it in place.
That's pretty neat, Thad said. Let me see it.
I handed him the snare and told the girls to get started twisting the wire up. Just be sure not to twist it too tight. Hey, Thad, let's go get a piece of wood. Thad nodded and followed me out toward the woods. I was looking for a limb not too big in diameter. Seeing a possible contender, I picked it up and waved it around. We need some limbs like this.
We looked around and found four of them and carried them back to the table. Now, wrap the loose end around the limb like this. I showed Thad how to secure the snare to the limb and how to space them and position the open snare on it so the squirrel would go through it. We'll lean these against trees at an angle. I put one end on the ground and leaned it against the trunk of one of the nearby trees. And when they run up it, they'll get trapped.
Why don't you just shoot them? Taylor asked.
You used to go hunting for them.
Because this way we can hunt while doing other things. It will work for us all day long. She nodded. Once everything was ready, we took the snares out into the woods near the camp. The place was full of limb rats, and Thad and I agreed it would be a productive spot. I looked for trees that showed signs of feeding. Piles of cut shells of hickory nuts and acorns were a dead giveaway. We leaned the limbs against these trees and put a dab of peanut butter between the snares.
Will this actually work? Leanne asked.
Sure. Squirrels love peanut butter. If they come from either the top or the bottom of the tree to get the peanut butter, they'll have to pass through the snares.
Will the snares kill them?
They can. Sometimes they will. Sometimes they'll be alive.
Sounds kind of mean.
Well, we have to eat, and they aren't just going to climb up on the table and lie down for us.
I'm not going to eat them, Taylor said.
I looked at her with my eyebrows raised.
It's just meat, Taylor.
And if you get hungry enough, you will. You've had it before anyway.
She looked at me and scowled.
Yeah, but you didn't tell us until after we ate it.
I remember that, Leanne said.
Me too, and as I remember it, you guys liked it till I told you what it was.
Thad laughed.
Yeah, funny how that works out. When we got back to the cabin, Mel was in the garden plot plucking the weeds that were beginning to sprout. The small plants that were transplanted were precious to us, and it was very important that all of them survive. This was no hobby garden.
I'm going to go check on the hogs. Thanks for the lesson, Morg, Thad said as he walked off.
Little Bit held up a tiny seedling.
Look, Daddy, it's a baby.
She had a big smile on her face.
Yep, but it's the wrong kind. Let's get this garden cleaned up.
We're going to go look for eggs, Taylor said. I nodded at them, and they turned to leave. Little Bit jumped up.
I want to help.
The girls ran off, leaving me and Mel sitting in the garden. Mel crawled out of the garden and spread out on the grass. I lay down beside her, propped up on an elbow.
It's nice out. The sun feels good, she said.
It does, I said, looking upward. I think it's going to start warming up.
That'd be nice, she said.
Her eyes were closed, and she was resting her head on her hands.
Yeah, but that means it's going to get hot soon.
And that means there'll be mosquitoes. Don't forget about them.
Oh, yeah, a shitload of them, I said with a chuckle.
The weather had been warm for several days, probably in the upper 60s. One thing I wish I had was a weather station with a thermometer, barometer, and hygrometer for humidity. That would be handy now that the Weather Channel was no longer on the air. My grandfather had one hanging on the wall in his living room back in the day. A nice brass instrument on a teak plank. The girls came running back over.
Mom, look at all the eggs we got today.
Taylor hollered as she came up. All three of them had their hands full.
Wow, that's a lot of eggs. Good work, girls, Mel said, sitting up and brushing the grass off her hands.
We should make something with them, Taylor said.
Yeah, Mommy, what can we make?
Little Bit asked.
It depends. What do you want?
Something sweet.
You can make that custard that you've made before, I said.
Yeah, can we make custard, Mom?
Leanne asked.
Please? It reminds me of when we made it with Grandma last Christmas.
She looked down at the ground and muttered,
I miss Grandma.
Mel got up and patted Leanne on the shoulder.
Oh, I remember. Your grandma sure is good in the kitchen. Let's see if we can make it as good as she did. You guys want help?
All the girls nodded, and she led them toward the cabin. I got up and went over to the picnic table. Thad was coming from the pig pen and met me there.
We may have a problem, he said.
Oh yeah, what's up?
Someone's been snooping around the pig pen.
That got my attention.
Really? You sure?
Yeah. Come on, I'll show you.
I followed Thad back to the pen. On the far side of the pen, he stopped and pointed at the ground.
See the tracks?
I do.
It's kind of hard to tell how many people there were or what they were doing.
That's what's interesting, he said. The tracks go all the way to the creek.
I followed Thad as he pointed out the tracks leading down to the creek, north of the cabins.
Looks like they crossed here, he said.
I knelt down and looked closer at the bank.
Yeah, I don't see where a boat was pulled up. They must have waded across.
That's what I thought, too.
Kind of strange to come over and not take anything.
Thad jerked his chin toward the other side of the river.
What's back there?
Nothing, for a long, long ways.
We may need to keep an eye on things for a couple of days. You still got that night vision?
Yeah, I got something else we can put over here, too.